In the last episode, we considered the college essay. What are the best approaches to this part of the application and how to create one that will appeal to admissions officers? We will now turn to a core principle in college consulting, how to identify a student's personality and help develop this personality, and most importantly, how to fit it in with a quality school. I'll be joined by Rebecca Elmore of Peak Consulting. Before opening Peak, Rebecca worked in the business world for 7 years, using leadership and managerial skills to run a multi-million-dollar company of over 200 contracted employees. Prior to experience in business, she was home, busy raising her 4 children, 2 girls and 2 boys. Before having her children, Rebecca was a middle school teacher where she taught in Westfield, New Jersey. She received her BS in education from Wheelock College, which is now part of Boston University in Boston, Massachusetts, not far from her hometown of Exeter, New Hampshire. Using her business knowledge and her love for education and children, she opened Peak when she realized there was a need for college consulting, and she went through the process with her own children. Ultra organized and passionate about finding the right college fit for each student, she knew she could use her personable touch and her way with students to become a successful independent educational consultant. Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, could you explain your background and specifically what got you into college counseling?
Yeah, sure. So, I have a degree in education and started out as a teacher. Teaching middle school for many years before all my children came and I stopped teaching. And I eventually, when I said, okay, what am I going to do now? I actually started an efficiency company where I worked with companies to make them quite a bit more efficient. So time management, executive functioning skills, things like that, paper waste, communication, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And I got involved with this woman who was starting her own company, and she was big picture. And I'm a little picture. I'm a small, detail-oriented person. Mm-hmm. And she needed someone like me to help her run her company. And for about 7 or 8 years, that's what I did. Side by side, we ran a small company that turned very large, a multi-million-dollar company with over 200 employees. And I did everything from, you know, working with our consultants, working with the lawyers and the accountants, you know, managing the expectations of what is the next project we could do, that kind of thing. I have no business background whatsoever, but I loved that part of the job, the growing of the business, the different aspects. However, I wasn't with students and I really missed that part, was the missing piece. And someone literally one day said, "You make a great college counselor." And I don't even know what that is. So in kind of around that same time, my older 2 boys were in the beginning of high school, and I looked into, actually my title is an independent educational consultant, and some of us work with college, some work with secondary private schools like, you know, in Exeter or in Andover, and some are therapeutic consultants where they work with students that might need to go into a therapeutic placement or something like that. So my focus has been college. So I literally researched it to figure out what it was, and it was everything that was me. So working with people, working with students, the business aspect, using all of my executive functioning skills, all wrapped up into one job. So I went back to school and got my certificate and started my own company.
Now, you mentioned your kids, and I think you said you had 4. How has that experience as a parent kind of shaped what you do as a college counselor?
Yeah, so, you know, both being a teacher and having 4 of my own children and all of their, you know, friends over and whatnot, I can just appreciate the differences between children. And I think that, you know, when we think about college, we think about, oh, you know, the really bright kids go off to college and the other kids, you know, well, it's not for them. If a child wants to go to college, there's a college for them. I actually love this about my job is that every kid is unique. Just like my own 4, they could not be any more different. Every one of them is strengths and weaknesses, very different. They've landed in different career paths. Their education was completely different from each other's. So it has helped me just kind of, just like a teacher, knowing that every child is a gift and has gifts, and to find those gifts and to help them pursue that and pursue their desires and what's best for them. So I think it did help me because, like I said, my four kids could not be any more different.
Right. I'm laughing, of course, because I'm a parent of three myself, yeah. So I know exactly what you're talking about. I would say this, though. There are patterns. There are templates to students, I guess, while what you said is also 100% true as well, and that everyone is entirely unique.
Sort of right. And when you think you figured it out, someone throws you a curveball, and it's not that at all.
Right.
You know,
right.
So it's, I mean, I can't imagine working in a job where everything is just cut. I mean, literally every meeting, every kid, every appointment is different than the next. You know, I don't know what to expect from them. I don't know what I'm going to get out of them. I don't know what their life experiences are. We're in the middle of essay writing right now. Mm-hmm. And it's when I put my therapist hat on and, you know, mm-hmm. you hear a lot of stories about what these kids have endured, not just the COVID, you know, the COVID thing, but just in life in general, you know, hardships or mental health. You know, family dynamics, health issues. So, you know, at some point they start to really respect me because I respect them. They're able to share that and be open with me. And then them becoming more vulnerable helps me do a better job for them. So it's kind of this, and I'm surprised. I always get surprised by when kids tell me, I'm like, I would never have thought that, or I had no idea.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. You refer to being therapist.
Unofficial, so I don't want to say that.
Well, yeah, no, of course.
Because I'm not a therapist.
Well, yes, of course. Let's not violate HIPAA rights here. But
I don't want anyone calling me saying you don't have a degree in that or you don't have a license. But yes, I mean, there's a lot involved. And part of it is that, you know, I always say what we do, it's not brain surgery, right? It's pretty research. It's learning about new, you know, new issues in the educational world. It's visiting colleges. It's understanding, you know, different things that the schools are looking for and whatever. There's a lot to learn, but it's pretty straightforward as far as, you know, you can learn it, you can research, whatever. But you can't teach someone how to connect with kids. I think you either have that ability or you don't. So when I looked at increasing my staff, it was important for me to, I could train them, but I couldn't teach them that piece. They had to either have a way with kids or they didn't. And to me, once I make the connection with the kids, it's like a light bulb goes off. They have a trusted adult in their corner. They know what they're going to say to me. I'm not going to go tell their mom and dad that they just said that, you know, a swear. You know, I'm not going to report everything back to their parents and tell them this is what she said. My disclaimer is if I ever feel like you're in a place where you're going to hurt yourself or hurt somebody else, then I will get the parents involved. But otherwise, it's the relationship between me and the student. And I think having a trusted adult in your life, especially during these times, is really important. So we often become that trusted adult.
Yeah. Well, you're preaching to the choir there.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, every student, whether they're getting tutored or trying to apply for college, could use a trusted adult in their life that's not their mom and dad.
It's critical. Yeah, absolutely. So could you, I'm getting a sense of it, but could you explain your sort of core philosophy as a college counselor? What do you think the main sort of objective is?
So, you know, kind of like we were talking about is just making sure that each child feels valued and respected first and foremost, and to look at them as individuals. So I know some of the things you'd ask me were about, you know, can you get one kid? Can you think like, oh, this kid is like this kid and I'll give them the same schools? Yes, that does happen. But, you know, I'll have students that are straight A students, you know, perfect test scores that are looking at Ivy League. And then I have some kids that have 2.0s and had a few missteps and feel like failures and just want another chance. So making sure that for each kid, we individualize them is so key to our program, because we can do the program. We, you know, we have a pretty strict program outline of what we do from beginning to end, but we're always flexible with that depending on who the kid is. So I think flexibility, making sure the kids are valued and respected. After that, it just kind of happens. But that's the core of our philosophy is for all of us that work here.
Here are a few of my observations following the first segment of my conversation with Rebecca. One point that she brought up in highlighting some of her own strengths was the notion that college counselors should essentially have multiple abilities in terms of what they can offer students. Many hats is one of the cliches used to explain that. I think that's true, very much so. I mean, when you're talking about the college list, when you're talking about doing the interview prep, extracurricular support, developing the college essay, I mean, it's just a skill set really that covers sort of a lot of different ground. So finding somebody who is versatile in that way, I think, is pretty key and fairly unique. I think there are a lot of college counselors that can do some of those things very well, but doing all of them well is far more rare. Another thing that stuck out to me in our conversation was how to understand the students that we do run across in college consulting. She mentioned really that every kid is different, and having that sort of new mind, that fresh mind when you're approaching every kid is important because you don't want to start with assumptions. At the same time, there are certainly templates, and I think it's sort of important that we match our understanding of a new human being based on the context that we've been given beforehand. So there's a bit of a paradox that's at play there in terms of the newness of understanding an individual and then matching that with what we previously understood, never more so than with college counseling, when you are really matching them with a finite set of things. I mean, yes, there are tons of schools, around 4,500 in the United States, so that is a lot, but it is a finite set of things. So I think finding a way to sort of walk the line between, you know, the newness of an individual and their infinite capability for difference and diversity, and matching that with the finite system that you bring previous understanding to, is really key in the college admissions process. Another thing that stuck out to me was the personal connection and the rapport that she created with them. She almost likened it to the relationship that one would have with a therapist. It's interesting because she used the same language that occurs when you're talking about therapy, which is that you have this privilege of privacy between therapist and client, or educational consultant and client in this case, where you're not going to tell these sort of parents or reveal to other people that are involved some of the things that are disclosed in those sessions, unless, as she mentioned, there's a safety issue. And, you know, to extend that with therapy, you'd be talking about, well, threat of harm to oneself or to others. So I think that's true. And I think that happens actually in tutoring as well. When you're talking about a relationship of trust, particularly with a young person who's going to reveal very intimate and things that make them quite vulnerable, that you want to have that privilege of safety, even when parents are involved, to be able to have that trust and to be able to develop that relationship to a place where it can be very valuable in that critical turning point in their lives. So I found that very interesting, and it got me thinking about the connection really between therapy and college consulting. Where do you typically begin with a new student, and what do you look for?
So we don't necessarily have a typical. I mean, when we have kids, you know, parents calling at like sixth and seventh grade, we ask them to slow their roll and let their kid be a middle schooler for a little bit and reach back out to us when they're entering ninth grade if they would like to do it that early. It's beneficial to everyone, students, parents, and the consultants, to meet on the earlier side, because we can do things like help with class placement and class selection. So this is the class that my teacher suggested I go into, or this is my class guidance counselor said I should go into, or no one told me anything and this is the class I chose. So we could talk about that. I was like, well, if you want to be an engineer, you're on this track, you're not going to be able to get to calculus as a senior. What can we do to make sure that we can help you get to that calculus as a senior? So we talk about class placement and rigor, but we can start that in ninth grade. So we can kind of have a plan for 4 years. It's more difficult if we get someone second semester, junior year, they've already taken all their high school classes and they've already planned for senior year. So we do help with that.
I'm sure you get those, though. I mean,
we do. I mean, I'm lucky enough to fill up on the early side. So my students, I take 35 students per graduating year. So right now I'm working with 35 rising seniors, and I have, I think, about 25 rising juniors. So once I fill up, then they go to my team. So I never get second semester juniors anymore because I'm filled. But they do come. A lot of them are coming now and, you know, panicking. But we do have space for them. They go to my colleague. Yeah, so we get some kids freshman year. Like, I already have a freshman roster, a sophomore roster, a junior roster. We also help with the extracurricular piece. So that's a big piece right now in college that, you know, when I was going to school, it was all about being well-rounded.
Yeah.
So they wanted you to do a little bit. Now what they realize is, well, by having students, every one of them are well-rounded and a little bit of everything, they don't really have specialties in anything. So now they've switched. So now it's, you know, what are you kind of an expert in? What are your passions and what have you done with those, mm-hmm. with that passion?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we talk about passion projects. We talk about, you know, the three things that schools are looking for in extracurriculars, which are soft skills, giving back to others, and intellectual curiosity. And how can you develop those within the next 3 or 4 years? So again, if we have someone that's a freshman, we can talk about what they're doing over the summer, you know, instead of coming to us too late. You can't make up 3 summers.
Could you elaborate a little bit on those 3 categories that's you right. brought up?
Yeah. So soft skills, schools are looking for kids with soft skills. Soft skills meaning time management, being able to communicate with adults, dealing with crisis or some sort of, say, work mishap.
How would you broadcast that on an application?
So in the application, there are 10 spots in an application on the Common App for activities, so for your extracurriculars. And there is, I know this sounds crazy, but there's a spot where you explain that activity in 150 characters. So if you think of what 150 characters short. Is, it's very short. Yeah. So we have perfected the art of getting as impactful of a statement as we can in 150 characters. We use fragmented sentences. We don't use I, we, me. We don't use any of that. But in there, we can talk about what they've learned in their job. You know, I've learned how to be patient with customers who are wrong. You know, I've learned how to manage my time when I have to be at work at, you know, 7 o'clock every morning throughout the summer. So they're seeing those soft skills. Plus, schools also know that soft skills come with school sports, team sports, having a job, you know, that is implied, but there is a way to document it as well. So they're looking for those kids that have had jobs, right? Who have been on team sports, who have had to ride the bench, who have had to take their turn. Those are all different soft skills that college sports have.
Interesting.
One of the things that we talk about is, it, you know, kids think that has to be through an organized company or service or something like Special Olympics or, you know, Salvation Army, Habitat Humanity, but it doesn't need to be. And I always challenge them to come to a way to give back to others in something that you're passionate about. So my youngest plays hockey in college. And so I was like, okay, how can you give back to others in high school using that love of hockey? So she would volunteer for Learn to Skate or Learn to Play Hockey. Maybe right. she's a goalie, so she could do, you know, goalie instruction with other young girls who, you know, she wants to let them know you can do this, you know, even though hockey is a, you know, thought of as a men's sport, you know, I beg to differ. And this is my experience. So also being kind of a mentor to the younger students. So it doesn't have to be volunteering in this, you know, organization. It can be something that you make up by yourself. One of my favorite stories is during COVID, everything blew up for these kids. So all the plans that they had in the summer, they couldn't do because everything was shut down. So I challenged them to figure out a way to still do some sort of passion project volunteering, but do it in a safe way. So I had these two boys who didn't know each other. One was a beautiful guitar player. So we came up with this idea that maybe he could go to a retirement home that had balconies. And ask if the people could come out to their balconies, their individual balconies, and he would play music for them. Just, you know, a way to enjoy some simple music on a Sunday afternoon. And he loved the guitar, so anytime just to play was great for him. And he was stuck at home anyway, so that was a great way for him to get out. And then, I don't know, somehow in my brain, I thought of the idea of another student who was a photographer. He did it as just a passion. It was he wasn't going to school for that, but a hobby of his. And I said, well, what happens if we tie these together? And as these men and women are listening to this music, he could take these beautiful photographs and send them to their family who hasn't seen them for months on end because they can't get into the home.
Ooh, you got them working together.
Collaborate. So they worked together, didn't know each other, came from two different schools, and it turned into this beautiful relationship with them. But then they had these parents, these children that were calling and emailing saying, oh my goodness, thank you so much. These were these beautiful black and white photos of their loved ones sitting outside on the balcony listening to music. And it was just a great way to show kids, like, you can make a difference, even if it's for those 10 people. And it really wasn't just those 10 people, because it was also the people that worked in the retirement home also got to enjoy it. They got to see the people so happy. The families got to see pictures of their loved ones. So
that's definitely cool.
Teaching them that.
Yeah.
And then, sure. And then intellectual curiosity, schools, especially, you know, more of the elite schools, you know, we call them the highly rejective schools that say no to most kids.
They are now, aren't they? Yeah.
So they're looking for not just kids with great scores, with great rigor, with great grades. They're, now they have to be able to say, what else? Because you and everybody else, you look the same. So this intellectual curiosity is, it's not for everybody. And I don't make anyone do anything, but it's just, I put it out there. But intellectual curiosity is, what can you do outside of school to show your passion or interest for a particular subject? So we talk about those trips, those service trips that are $10,000. You know, that's not giving back to others, right? That's mom and dad writing a check for $10,000 and you're maybe helping for 2 hours and then you're sightseeing for the rest of the day. That's different than intellectual curiosity. So an example of, I have a student right now who really wants to get to differential equations in high school. And he realized he couldn't do that until he took linear algebra. So he took it upon himself to go to his math teacher and say, is there a way that you would teach a linear algebra summer program that you then could take differential equations senior year? And the teacher was amazing. He said, yes, I'll do it if you can get 10 kids that are qualified and want to do it.
So how would you put that then on the application or the resume?
That's a great question, because it's not going on his transcript. So he'll have differential equations on his transcript because he's taking that to his school senior year, but not the linear algebra. So what we put it in as one of his activities. And so one of his activities is that he took linear algebra, he organized it, he facilitated it. So it's not only showing his intellectual curiosity that he actually took this math class, but who wants to take linear algebra anyways, never mind in the summer. but he also coerced his friends into it too. And the teacher to teach it. And then the teacher to had to figure out how to teach differential equations in September. So that's showing intellectual curiosity.
Yeah, showing a few things. Yeah. All right, cool. Your site mentions something called the whole person method. And then as part of that, it mentions something that had an intriguing title, the Use Science Ability Battery.
Right.
So what are those concepts and where did they originate and how did they develop? Yeah. Tell us about that.
So the whole person method is tied into Use Science, believing that, you know, we should look at a student's natural innate abilities along with their interests. So how can you tie their innate abilities, their interests, and their kind of their personal style. So when I mean personal style, I mean, are you more introverted or extroverted or somewhere in between? What does your time frame look like that? When you think out into the future, are you the kind of person that thinks out a month or 10 years? Are you always kind of planning for that 10-year mark? Well, in 10 years, this is what I'm going to be doing, and this is what I need to do to get there. Or are you kind of a kid that's like, you know, I'm living in the moment. I know in the next month, these are the things that I want to do or I need to do. And then all in between that.
Is this like some sort of survey or like thing with radio buttons that you have them fill out at the beginning?
So part of it is just me getting to know them and asking just, you know, kind of open-ended questions and trying to get more information from them. I have a pretty good sense by the third or fourth meeting whether they're more introverted or extroverted, even when they talk to me about social situations and things like that. But the Use Science test incorporates all of those questions. But you don't fail the test. It's all in within a range. There's no right or wrong. There's no good or bad. You know, it used to be on a bar graph, and so kids would be like, oh, anything to the left is bad, anything to the right is good. I'm like, no. A lot of them are brain puzzles. So they're just different ways to test different parts of the brain. So what is innate and natural? Then there are some also just surveys. So, you know, one of the questions might be, if you entered a room and you knew nobody, would you be the person that would wait to be introduced, or would you go and introduce yourself? You know, those kinds of questions. And the same with the interest. You know, there's a lot of interest inventories like Strong and Myers-Briggs, but those are pretty, it's pretty easy to steer one way or the other, and you pretty much know what they're asking, you know, and you come out and you're like, oh, if I answer this way, they're more like science, math, engineering. Oh, if I answer this way, preschool teacher. These are brain puzzles. And so one, the kids usually like them. And two, there are pros and cons, whatever the results are. So for instance, if you are a fast processor, you're going to score a certain way on the test, meaning you can intake information, make a decision, give something back out. If you're a slow processor, that takes longer. But in most tests, it would be one way is better than the other. But when we think of, say, processing speed, if someone wants to be an emergency room doctor and they have slow processing speed,
it's not going to go very well, is it?
Not going to be the person that I want.
Many heart attacks.
Right. And also the pressure of that, of having people needing you to make that decision right now, and you just need a minute. So I can say to a kid, you want to be a doctor? That's amazing. But maybe you need to rethink what type of doctor. There are researchers or, you know, oncologists. They're not having to make snap decisions. They have to think, process, take their time.
That's a good point. Yeah,
and someone who is a fast processor could be annoyed by that, could be annoyed by just the slowness of it, right? And their impatience. But also slow processors usually process better. So I'm a quick processor, but I know that my husband, who is a slow processor, once he gets to the answer or the conclusion, is probably better.
More detailed.
More detailed, right. Where I'm like, oh, what about this? What about this? What about that?
Yeah, I'm the same. Yeah.
So you need both people in the world, right, to be able to do certain jobs and even to work together. If you think about if we're brainstorming an idea together, you know, I could be the person like, oh, and someone else would be sitting back there going, she's thinking. But that one thought she had just made me think of something, and now that's what we're going to go with because collaboratively.
Yeah, totally.
So that's what the U-Science does. It kind of pulls back. There's 14 tests that they take, and it's all looking at different things, like how do you communicate? How do you process? How do you visualize things? Are you a person that can visualize space? There's some engineering ones. There's one that's, you know, you fold a piece of paper in half, and then half again, and then you pick up a corner and I punch a hole in it. If I open it up, can you tell me where the holes would be? You know, and then they would, on the computer, you know, tell you where those holes would be. So the purpose of this is for the children to realize that they have strengths and they have natural abilities that without studying for or whatever, just have the way their brain thinks. And how can we tie that in with their interests, with their personal style, to careers that possibly would be good fits for them?
That's a great system. I like that.
I think everybody should have to do it. I think adults, it makes you also understand other adults, even knowing that the way you think is an ability, because it took me until I was an adult to realize that not everybody had those natural abilities that I have. I just thought everybody's brain worked the same. Okay, yeah, she's a better writer and she's better at math, but I'm talking about if you gave me 7 different pictures that seemed unrelated, I could probably pick the 4 that were related because they were all made out of paper or they were all produced heat. And so taking information that's not related and connecting them. So for my job, that's a great ability to have because I'm doing that with everything firing at me and trying to make sense of that. I think I thought when I was younger that everybody could do that. So what I'm able to do is tell these kids, like, that is something you is uniquely you. But you have to understand that not everybody is like that. So maybe you have to be understanding if they don't get it the way you do, or they don't get it as quickly as you do. So it kind of opens their eyes to also understanding other people.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for taking me through that. A very good sense of your approaches. Changing gears a little bit, I'm just wondering if you have a list of go-to schools for certain types of students, perhaps that score a certain way on the science test, ones that are, you know, they kind of tend to like maybe a little bit more, just following your experience.
Yeah, so I don't use U-Science to find schools. I know some people might do that, but that's a whole different kind of thing for me. I take what I know about their whole person and tie that into also when I look for schools for them. So we look for schools for them. We ask a ton of questions and try to get to know them better. And there is oftentimes when kids talking about what they want in school, that it reminds me of a student that I had, you know, 2 years ago that was very similar, wanted the same thing, wanted the same major, wanted the same size. For sure, I can go back to that list and be like, you know, half of these are going to be great for this student as well. The longer I do it, the more I know the schools, I know the trends, I know what's hot, I know what schools kids are really interested in. My job is not only to support those schools, but also to bring in some schools that they've never heard of and to open their eyes. That's why they pay me, to open their eyes to other opportunities. Because part of this is finding schools that not half your graduating class is applying to because they can't take them all. So let's think outside the box, a school very similar, but maybe it's in a different part of the country or it's a school that you've not heard of. And I say to the kids all the time, there are 4,500 colleges out there. You haven't heard of all of them. And neither have I. So trying to be open to that. But yes, I mean, the longer you do it, you know, it used to take me probably 3 hours to do each college list for each student. And now, depending on the student, I can get through it pretty quickly. We do a lot of research. And so if I have a student that is, you know, a particularly unique student or a unique major, I've one right now that is interested in equine studies. And, you know, not a lot of schools have equine studies, and she also wants to ride. So we have to find a school where she can ride and have equine studies. And so now I'm learning. I'm like, oh, great. Like, I didn't know that, you know, this particular school. So say SCAD, she's looking at
Montana
SCAD.
Montana State, I bet.
Right. And then it's like, but I don't want to go to Montana. I'm like, okay, I want to be here. So it's just, so yeah, I'm learning all the time. We visit schools all the time. We are traveling. We just came back from a North South Carolina trip. I probably do 3 big trips a year where we just go see a bunch of schools at one time, meet with the admissions officers, get to know the school a little bit more intimately than I can just by researching.
Are there particular stories of success or maybe one in particular that sticks out to you?
Yeah, I mean, we could talk all day about this because, first of all, I have the best job in the world. Absolutely love my job. And I love, you know, when a kid comes in kind of unwilling, kind of questioning, why am I talking to him? I'm a sophomore in high school. This seems ridiculous. To, you know, oh my goodness, Rebecca, you've changed my life. Thank you so much. I'm so excited to attend this school. So, you know, obviously there's a lot going on in between those two views, but I do have a girl this year who was pretty ambivalent to the whole process and, you know, kind of on the quieter side and also very stressed about the process. Like she was so anxious about not necessarily getting in, but how it worked and how was she supposed to pick a school. And she had gone to see a couple of schools before she met with me and she just didn't like them. She went kind of kicking and screaming and I made her list for her. We went over every school and she, you know, I could see there was no involvement at all. And I just said to her, I said, I want you to pick 4 schools. And I want you to go visit them and then we'll talk more. So I kind of highlighted the 4 that I thought would be best for her and she came back. And she also had in-person visits with me, and she was literally vibrating with excitement. And almost like it was a different person. And I was like, what's up? And she said, I went and visited schools, and one of them I love. And that was probably early on, so she was probably, you know, winter of her junior year, so she had plenty of time to add schools and whatnot. Any school that she went to did not compare to that one school, and eventually, when it came down to applying, she applied ED there and she got in and she's so excited. Yeah. And it doesn't always happen because then some kids are waiting for that feeling and they're like, but I'm not getting that feeling. It's like, well, it's like falling in love. Some people fall in love first, you know, at first sight. Some people fall in, you know, it's falling in love. It takes a while. You know, they read about, oh yeah, you're supposed to have this aha moment. It doesn't happen for everybody, for sure.
Here are a few things that stuck out to me about the second part of my conversation with Rebecca. She mentioned specifically that she has a cohort of 35 students per class, 35 rising seniors, she said, 35 rising juniors, and that she's sort of considered as filled up for her cohort. I think that's a critical number in thinking about determining a college consultant. You know, we are finite beings as far as our attention and our energy and what we are able to devote to everything we do. I mean, our aspirations are limitless at times. It's, you know, our goals don't necessarily have to fit in with the world's restrictions. But At the end of the day, you only have so much of your personal pie to give to all of these aspirations. So I think the number of ways that you are dividing that pie necessarily defines that experience. Just like looking at class sizes and faculty to student ratio is so important in determining schools, I think the number of students per consultant is critical in determining how much you're ultimately going to get as far as attention from that consultant. Now, there are many caveats to that because you don't know who those other students are that are taking up part of the bandwidth, and you don't know how that consultant handles that division. So certainly not entirely universal, but I do think it's a critical measure in determining that. Another thing that stuck out to me was her description of how approaches to applications have essentially been reversed at this point. About 20, 30 years ago, you're really talking about, okay, let's get the test scores in place and the GPA and those sorts of basic metrics, and then we'll worry about extracurriculars and X factors. Well, now it's essentially impossible to stick out in those traditional ways that we were just talking about because of the increased competitiveness and of the de-emphasis on some of those things with grade inflation and all the complications with test scores. So now you're talking about those extracurriculars and those X factors really taking the lead when you're putting together these applications. She put it in three categories: soft skills, giving to others, and curiosity. Very interesting. And I think if you can begin to sort of categorize things that way and begin to develop those things at an earlier age, you can strategize on how to tell that story in a way that's going to allow you to lead with the X factors in an application versus having those be something that you fill in later. Another thing that stuck out to me was the U-Science system. They utilize a form of test using, as she said, puzzles and brain teasers of sorts to suss out the underlying abilities that you have in terms of cognition, in terms of your penchant to perform various roles, and as a form of projection, what you're best going to be suited to in your future career. I mean, kind of building backwards, determining your best college path and your best fit based on that projection. I think that's an interesting way of doing it. And she mentioned the example of an ER doctor. If you have a slower working memory, which yours truly is included, you're not going to want to be an ER doctor. It's not going to be a great fit for you. You're not going to save many heart attacks by having to think things through at a much slower rate. However, there are better fits as far as in research, etc. So I would be very interested to see what a set of results would look like on that and how that would be applied. I'd be curious to see the mathematical application of those approaches. How has the post-pandemic climate impacted the process of identifying students and targeting a list of schools?
Yeah, I mean, so part of this is that when the pandemic happened, first of all, I have to say, I can't believe that no one thought about this earlier, but when the pandemic hit, colleges had to pivot pretty quickly because no one could go visit their school, right? I mean, pivot in a lot of ways, but admissions-wise. So they all created virtual tours, which wasn't a thing before then, which is kind of odd because the technology was there, right? But no one just really went ahead and did that. But now every school have virtual tours. And what that's caused is more students applying to more schools because it's easy to go in, watch a virtual tour, and say, oh, I like that school, I'm going to apply. But the application increase since COVID has been crazy. You know, schools that were getting, 20,000 applications are now getting 50,000 applications. But the problem is they're not really getting to know the schools because they're thinking, oh, I did a virtual tour, that's fine. And we know there's a very big difference. Right? You're only seeing the bells and whistles and the nice dorms and the nice cafeterias and the great. So what's happening is then the wait lists are becoming really long because schools are trying to figure out their yield. So they're trying to figure out who's actually going to come to the school. And if it's a person who just checked off a box on the Common App, they would never follow on social media, never went on mailing list, never went on the website, never visited school, all those things that we call demonstrate interest. They rate them and they're like, well, my guess is that Rebecca's not going to come to the school. She's just checked off a box on the Common App because.
How do they tell that? How can they identify?
Because they track it. So they track demonstrated interest. They're all based on data analytics. So they'll do if a kid gets on a mailing list, now they have their IP address in there and their email address. Now they can tell when that kid goes on to their website and how long they've been on the website. When they send an email, they can tell how long it took for a student to open up an email, and if they did open it, and if they did the call to action. So if I sent you 5 emails, I would relate this to social media with the kids and say, listen, if someone sent you a snap and they liked you, but you didn't respond, they're going to say, well, you don't like me, right? Because you didn't open up their snap. It's the same way. If you don't open the email, colleges are going to say, well, you can't be that interested. It's a total game.
What a world, man.
Right.
No privacy. It's crazy. Right.
So this demonstrated interest, they'll give a score or a grade. And so when an application comes in, they can look at their data analytics and say, okay, look at this kid has visited twice, met me when they went to school. They've written me 3 emails. They wrote a thank you note. And they've been on the email. They open up all their emails. This kid is more likely than this kid to say yes to us. So wait lists are high because of yield protection. And the other thing is test optional has really changed a lot of kids thinking, oh, I can't get into that school, or thinking, oh, now I can get in because I don't have to have my test scores. But if you take a test and you score within the 50% of their accepted students from last year, then statistically sending your scores in, if they are high enough, are going to be beneficial to you. So that's also something we have to think about, each and individual school. This is your SAT score. This is what school A's average was last year of accepted students. We're not going to send yours. This is B school. Oh yeah, we're going to send it. So you have to be really strategic in test scores as well. And then the other kind of thing that's really kind of a trend is now is the ED or early decision. And it really blew up during COVID and now post COVID because they have so many more applicants. You know, when I went to school, I ED'd and I was kind of an anomaly. It wasn't something that a lot of my friends did or even knew about. And now it is often the ticket to get into those highly rejected schools.
It's like the only way. I know that generically speaking, it's like a 4% acceptance rate for, you know, for like an Ivy League or something like that. If you're applying ED, what's the rate for that? Is that in the team?
So that's interesting because we look at those numbers a lot. I mean, it really depends the school and what those numbers look like, but it can get up to 18, 20%.
Oh my gosh.
Wow. Yeah, it's a huge advantage. Some get like Holy Cross with something like, this was last year's stats. I don't know what this year's stats are, but last year's stats were something like, you know, say 30% acceptance rate, but when they ED'd, it was like 65%. And some schools are filling more than half of their class with the ED kids.
That's conservative. I mean, that's a safe way to do it.
It is safe. Yeah. It protects their yield. But not every 17-year-old is ready to say, yes, I'm committed to that school right now. And we talk about being ethical, and the contract says that if I get accepted to school, I will go to the school. So I say to the kids and the parents, if you are not willing and able to pay for that and you change your mind, then do not sign that ED agreement, because it can really affect the post high school. So if you have a kid, say they ED to BC and then they pulled out, that looks bad. So when BC is looking at that high school another for another kid another year, they may be like, you know what, we've had 3 kids from that school pull out from their ED agreement. We're not going to take that kid. So it can also affect future students in your high school. So,
I mean, do other schools find out about that too, though? So
I don't know how. Honestly, I don't know how they find out about it. But word on the street is yes, that if you ED somewhere and you pull out and then you apply ED2 somewhere else, or you apply regular decision, that there is the danger of that school knowing that you pulled from an ED app, and they don't want to be involved in that.
Big data for you right there. Mm-hmm. Everybody's watching.
Yeah. I don't let my students get into those situations where that's going to happen. I kind of give the parents and the kids a pretty strong talking to before we sign that ED agreement.
Okay. Very interesting stuff there. If you had one piece of parting advice for parents of these young adults, or perhaps the students themselves, what would that be?
First of all, don't get wrapped up in rankings because I've never heard of that school, or, you know, my friend said they never heard of that school. You know, I tell the kids, just kind of put muffles over your ears and don't listen to, oh, my neighbor, she went to this school, so I'm going to apply there. She loved it. Okay. I mean, majority of kids love their college. You can't just go there because a neighbor loved it. And don't get too wrapped up in the rankings, because the rankings are just garbage. It's so full of nonsense that some schools are just pulling out of being part of the rankings because they realize it's just not really, there's not a lot of value to that. And then the other piece for parents is remember that this is your child's journey, not yours. So you've already had your turn. This is their journey. This is their story, not yours.
Here are some final thoughts after my conversation with Rebecca. One thing that really stuck out in the third part of our conversation was the way that she described that colleges actually research how engaged and interested a student is in their school when they're determining yield numbers. In other words, projecting how many kids are actually going to accept their offers of admission and determining the final numbers, their budgets. There are things that they do need to consider in putting together these classes. So the fact that they can see the click rates and how long you've been engaged with things. And they're using those very commercial big data principles. Really was striking to me. I had not imagined they were doing those things, but it just reminds me how little privacy we have in our lives and really in all mediums, in all areas. And I guess it reminds me too that we can't hide when you're talking about these colleges and that it is a neutral decision to attend a school, that you do have to be interested in that school. It can't just be kind of throwing your application in a pile, which was perhaps a decent approach, you know, 10, 20 years ago. But now that's going to be revealed. Like, you cannot hide the fact that you are only casually engaged because of all of these data protocols. So that's very interesting to me. I think that's a game changer in terms of how you should approach putting the list together and in following up on those applications and it's showing interest. That's a key part of the process now, and it wasn't before. Another thing that stuck out to me, and perhaps this is nothing new, but I guess hearing it in those numbers in particular, that early decision really makes such a big difference and is so universal at this point that it's almost foolish not to do some sort of early decision, or at least early action. When you're talking about a highly competitive school, having a breakdown between 4% admissions rate on regular decision versus 18 to 20%. We're talking about the early decision. That is a big disparity. And it's almost like regular decision is a complete shot in the dark at this point, because I mean, who knows what's going on with those 4%. So they've got to be truly exceptional for one reason or the other. And there's got to be circumstances that are leading to those acceptances too, that even perhaps skew those numbers even more if you did not include those special circumstances. So it's almost basically impossible to get into those schools. The number is near zero if you're talking about regular decision. So that's intimidating for somebody who's 17. You know, we talked about the fear of commitment, and certainly that resonates with me personally, you know, to think that there's no going back on this and, you know, getting read the riot act. That's a little scary. And I think that's something that is going to require some coaching specifically for some kids who struggle with that type of commitment.